this is where Texas politics gets interesting. Here again are two guys named Jason, some great guests, and cold Texas beer for another smart conversation on Y'allitics, the unofficial political podcast of Texas.
All right, hey everybody, we are back for another episode of Y'allitics. We don't have beers this time because Jason is finally doing a dry January, right?
Finally, I do it every time, man.
Yeah. You start off that way every time.
I don't drink like you though, Wheeler. we're at the Y'allitics Global headquarters right now, and normally we do have a beer, especially for the new year. We should, but there's too much going on right now with the inauguration happening on the 20th of President-elect Trump, and then the legislature.
It's
coming up in a couple of days here on the 14th of January.
Yeah, a lot going on. Usually we like to hear from voices on the inside who, you know, they know the lay of the land. They know where all the bodies are buried, and they can kind of walk you through it. This year we thought we'd do something a little bit different because there's a big freshman class coming in to the House of Representatives. I'm not sure, I haven't checked it against history, but this one looks like a larger one than what we're used to. There's been a lot of turnover there. I think it's more than 30 new members coming in.
32 new members, or 150 total members in the Texas House.
Yeah. And so quick math, that's one out of five is a new
one.
That's
pretty good, man. I'm impressed with you. Yeah, no beer, and your math is still that good, though. So, yeah, you know, like Jason said, we decided to get some fresh faces on this episode of Y'allitics that might have a different viewpoint. Mm-hmm. We reached out to two of them. Brent Money is one. He's a state representative-elect from East Texas. And we also reached out to Aisha Davis, a state rep-elect. She's a Democrat from Dallas County. Mm-hmm. But let's start with Brent Money, though, because he was telling us a lot of stuff. I was impressed with some of the things he shared with us.
Yeah, and you have to
And then
listen.
He dropped the bomb at the end, man.
I was going to say, you have to listen all the way through, though, because sometimes people do that. You know, you think that they're going to give you everything right up front, and you kind of get lulled as the conversation goes, and then boom, at the end, something that you just didn't anticipate.
Yeah. Here's Brent Money.
Hey, y'all. This is where Texas politics gets interesting. For another smart conversation on Y'allitics.
All right, we have state rep-elect Brent Money with us. Have you gotten used to the title yet?
No, I have not, and it's still a mouthful, state rep-elect.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. I bet so.
It's like, let's just get to the day so we can just call you Representative Money. First of all, thanks for being here. You're on your way to Austin to get things set up, situated. The session's about to begin. And we were chatting with you before we came on here, and I think this is really instructive because you said a lot of things that we didn't realize about the process. You've been through orientation now.
Yes.
What does that cover? Are you ready?
Yeah, I don't know if I'm ready or not. I think we spent about a week, and a lot of it was showing us where things are in the Capitol and
the
restroom. Here's, we had a nice Capitol tour. We met a lot of state agency directors and things like that. But man, there's still a lot to learn. I think that we're just gonna have to learn by fire.
Mm-hmm. And you've been to the Capitol before. You know how the process works. I think what people don't realize probably is that as an elected representative, you can't hire staff until you get sworn in. That's when the money starts coming for your office, right?
That's exactly right. So right now, I'm representative-elect, but I'm not a representative.
Sure.
So I don't have access to my office. I don't have a parking spot. I don't have staff. I don't have an email address. I don't have access to the state software to work.
You can't file any bills or anything.
There's really almost nothing you can do to do the actual job until you're sworn in and it's go time.
So you have all of these ideas after being elected. You want to start filing bills and so forth, and your hands are sort of tied at this point.
Yeah, you can do it, and a lot of the incumbents have helped us and said, hey, you give us the idea, we'll work through the process.
Wheeler does that all the time too. He wants to put his name on my work.
That's right. Yeah, give me all your good ideas. Yeah, right. I'll put it in, and I'll give you credit for it later.
That's working smarter, not harder.
That's right. So there's been a few reps have been very helpful with us trying to get us through the process, but yeah, we can't do anything on our own yet.
And did they, teach you parliamentary procedure? Like, do you know, how to speak and when to get up and what
not
to do?
Not really. I mean, I was on city council. Some of us have some background in party politics or things like that, but not really. A lot of and the House rules are a little bit different than Robert's Rules of Order and things like that. So we have a group of us has worked with a parliamentarian to try to learn some of those things on the side. But that's not something that the House really taught us.
But you got a good seat. You're close to the speaker.
I got a good seat. I'm on the middle aisle. right close to the front dais. Yeah. So
a little lottery system there for that?
Yes. So there's 32 incoming freshmen. I drew ping pong ball number 7. So 6 people picked before me, and then I had the pick of the
free reign
of the rest. Yeah.
Good. Who's that speaker going to be, though?
Well, yeah, that's the big you know, news right here. The big story is who's going to be elected speaker? David Cook from Mansfield or Dustin Burroughs from Lubbock? Who are you supporting?
I think it's going to be David Cook. David Cook is the Republican nominee. That's the person I'm supporting. But what I'm really excited about, and not just excited for myself, which will be fun, but excited for all of Texas, is that we're finally going to have a speaker debate and race out in front of the public. And that's not because people aren't talking behind the scenes and trying to work things out.
But Republicans have said for a long time they don't want that. Let's deal with this in caucus. Let's get someone nailed down, and let's all go out into the floor and all get behind this person.
And
that hasn't happened.
That would still be great. But what happened is, as we met in the caucus to try to decide, Dustin Burroughs and 25 of his friends walked out in unison and just basically abandoned the process. And so now we are in a spot where, we're trying to get them to come back to our side. They're trying to get us to, join them. And we're all courting Democrats and saying, hey, we think that the system that we're trying to put in place would be better for you guys. And so it's been a kind of a messy process, but it's going to be in front of everybody.
What should David Cook offer to Democrats to get them on board? Because right now, Dustin Burroughs apparently has more votes lined up with Democrats, obviously. What should Cook give them?
I think what I want Cook to give them is the same thing I want him to give me. It's just a fair chance to let your legislation work through the process. Mm. For too long in the Texas House, there has been a group of leadership that kind of decides which things move quickly, which things move slowly. And people that are in good graces get better bills and better committee assignments and better committee referrals for their bills, and the people that are on the outs don't. And so whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, you were elected by 200,000 Texans to go there and do a job. And so I the Democrats are in the minority. I hope they stay that way. That's great. But that doesn't mean they don't have ideas that need to be heard. They don't have things that matter for their districts. And they shouldn't have to say, well, I have to stay quiet on this thing to get my thing done, or I have to support this thing I don't like in order to get the thing that I want done. Every bill should stand on its own. People should be able to work their way through the process.
In a contested speaker election like this, though, Democrats are in the minority, but of course they hold a lot of power in deciding maybe who gets through. Is that enough, do you think, to sweeten the deal for Democrats, just, as you said, where anybody's bill can make it to debate there on the floor?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think that we make a mistake sometimes. Clearly, all Republicans don't think alike. I don't think all Democrats think alike. And so different people have different ideas of what matters to them, and they're going to listen to the reforms that David Cook has promised, and they're going to like some of them, and they're not going to like some of them. And they're going to hear what Dustin Burroughs has said and done and said, well, I would like to work for a speaker like that, or I do not want to work for a speaker like that. And so to me, I think for the minority party, what I would say is David Cook, on the day that we had our caucus meeting for speaker, a group of people that didn't want him to be speaker walked out of the room. Mm-hmm. And some of us said, okay, well, we have rules. Let's just go ahead and vote. And David Cook said, no, we're going to wait. We're going to let them come back. And then when it was apparent they weren't coming back, he called or texted every single one of them, people who he knew weren't going to vote for him, and said, come back to the room. Let's be a part of the process. Let's try to figure this out as Republicans. Let's unify. Some did, some didn't. But to me, I think that speaks to the character of a man who will reach across to people that he disagrees with and say, I want you to be a part of the process. I want to listen to you. And I think that's the kind of character of a speaker that I would want if I was in a minority. On the other hand, Dustin Burroughs, it wasn't getting his way. He left.
It's interesting when you say reach across, because this is reaching across to people in your own party. We've talked for the past couple of years about how there appear to be two different Republican parties here in Texas right now. Do you get a visceral sense of that when you're at the Capitol? And does that potentially hamstring Republican priorities going forward into these next 2 years?
It has hamstrung Republican priorities over the last 2 decades. And that doesn't mean there haven't been good things that have gotten accomplished. But I think the representatives that talk about, here's all the conservative things we've gotten done, I agree with that. But what they don't talk about is all the conservative things that we haven't gotten done and why that is. And so I was at a rally last night with Attorney General Ken Paxton and about 350 Texans who are tired of this business as usual house. And they think we continue to elect Republicans and Republicans keep putting the brakes on Republican priorities. And we don't want that. We want to see what true Republican governance would look like.
The Attorney General is on that statewide tour right now, urging these lawmakers who have sided with Dustin Burroughs to get behind David Cook and threatening them, saying, listen, I'm going to primary you if you don't get behind David Cook. What do you think about the retaliation?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you can call it a threat or a retaliation. It's more just a promise of the way things are going to be. The party made it clear, not now, but they made it clear at the convention that they wanted the House Republicans to follow the rules that are set in place on how to select a speaker. Rules that Dustin Burroughs wrote, actually. He was one of the original architects of this, hey, let's get together as a caucus and decide, back in 2017. And so I think that we had a good process in place. We might still be there if they hadn't walked out trying to decide which person would be able to unify the party. But what happened is when they walked out, they left us with an option between Cook and Calamity. That's it. It's going to be Cook, the Republican nominee, or we're going to have a mess on our hands.
Well, and I would wonder, though, would people on the other end of it say it's either Burroughs or Calamity, or you know, maybe they find some alliteration in there. But I'm curious, can you paper over that once this goes one way or the other, or is there going to be sort of this chasm in the Republican Party in the House?
I think the Republicans that decide that they are not going to support the Republican nominee, they're not going to have to answer to me. They're not even really going to have to answer to General Paxton. They're going to have to answer to their own voters. And that's where it's going to become very difficult. This is an issue that I think unites the Republican voters even more than the Paxton impeachment, more than school choice, more than a lot of the issues that have generated a lot of energy over the last primary season. This is something that's very easy for people to understand. Is my representative voting for the person that the Republicans wanted, or for the person who left the Republicans and ran to the Democrats?
Let's talk about some GOP priorities. School vouchers, top of the list. You and I have talked about this in the past. What do you think is going to happen this year? Are there finally enough votes to pass this?
I think there are enough votes to pass something called school choice. I've talked with a number of members. I mean, I don't have a whip count or anything like that. I think it's going to be important to see what that bill says.
Well, what do you want it to say? Because that's the big deal. You know, Governor Abbott wanted universal, I think, $8,000 or $10,000 per family across the state. Should it be universal or should it be more limited than that?
No, I think it needs to be absolutely universal. We have to put parents back completely in charge of their own education. And that doesn't mean people will say, well, parents have choice now. Well, I do. You guys probably do. But there's a lot of poor families, there's a lot of single parents that don't really have a choice, and they are in a school because they're in a zip code. Mm. And that doesn't even mean that school is necessarily bad. There's some great schools that aren't great fits for individual kids for whatever reason. And we need to put parents back in charge. So it needs to be universal. It needs to apply to every kid in Texas. Certainly we want to take care of the poorest kids first, but there needs to be enough funding for every kid.
And you think there are votes for that?
Man, I sure hope so. And I hope that the governor keeps his foot on the floor. The second thing is we cannot, this program can't infringe on the rights of private schools and homeschoolers to continue to do as they have been doing. So one of the tenets of the program is that it will only be allowed at accredited private schools. You can't just start up a private school next week and say, hey, we're good to go. But if you want to send your kid to an accredited private school, the state can't tell that private school who the enrollment is, who they can hire as teachers, what their curriculum has to be. I think that's critically important. And I think everybody kind of agrees with this. It needs to be separate from any kind of public school funding program. And it probably needs to be coupled with some deregulation of the public schools. I've said throughout my campaign that right now we have this heavily regulated public school environment that really nobody likes, but it's necessary when you have a government-run monopoly to make sure that there's a lot of regulations in place. If we open up to competition, then we should be able to strip away a lot of these crippling regulations and
such
allow.
Such as what? What kind of regulations?
I think the main one that I hear from superintendents, principals, teachers is classroom discipline. You know, I was a high school teacher in the early 2000s, and when I had a problem student, I could give them detention. I could call the assistant principal and get them out of there. You know, the principal could suspend them. Now the amount of paperwork that it goes through just to get a kid removed from your class, the limit, no matter what a kid does, I think that you can't have more than 3 days of suspension. There's a lot of these regulations that are really hurting the learning environment. And then with special needs kids with dyslexia, which I have kids with dyslexia, ADHD in my family, the amount of paperwork, it's like you spend more time explaining to the state what you did to help them than you do actually helping them.
I want to ask this because over the years it has been rural Republicans who have stood in the way of, you know, school choice vouchers getting through. You represent some rural areas. Are you hearing from people though who say, do not do this to our public schools? Do you have a contingent of people that you're, you know, loudly hearing from who are saying we like the public school system the way it is and this will handicap it?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And I think that where it's louder in the rural districts is because all of the communities in my district, except for Greenville, the largest employer is a school district.
Right.
And so people, I sat with some superintendents in my home county a few months ago, and I said, hey, I'm a CEO of a business that I own. If the state was talking about changing our industry the way they're talking about changing your industry, I'd be very concerned as well. I get it. I understand the concern. So we have to figure out a way to work through that. But I will tell you, I polled it during my campaign, very neutral question, and it's about 60-40 in favor of school choice, even in my very rural district.
Oh, wow.
Even though people, I would say, by and large, aren't disappointed with their own school, but they see the value of giving parents options.
So which way are you gonna vote? 60-40, I mean, that's a lot of, you know, a lot of constituents who don't want this.
Well, I have been for school choice, I mean, really my entire adult life, before it was even a big issue in Texas. So I'm gonna vote my principles on that one.
Your school-age children are homeschooled.
Yes.
Mm. Let's talk about two other issues here. I know your car's running outside. there will be an $18 billion surplus. What do you think should happen to that money?
We need to give it back to Texans.
How?
Through property tax compression. I'm open to other means of giving it back. Last time we had a $30 billion surplus, and I think we only gave about $12 billion of it back to Texans. And so
a certain portion has to go to the rainy day fund, though, I believe is the way it's set up, right?
Whatever, I mean, we're gonna follow the laws and the rules and the Constitution and things like that. I think one thing that every Texan that I talked with, I didn't have any Texan that I talked to during my campaign that said, I'm not taxed enough.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in fact, even with this historic tax refund the last time, not a tax refund, compression,
sure,
all
right,
of that,
property taxes.
Most people didn't see it on their bill,
right?
Because we still have out of control spending, both at the state and local level. We have the largest budget increase, I think, in state history, at least in a long, long time on a percentage basis. And we know we're a growing state and there's things that we have to do, infrastructure, water, highways, things like that. But everyone's belt is getting tighter at home and we need to tighten it at the government level.
Does that mean cutting some state programs or state departments?
Man, I sure hope so.
What do you want to cut?
I don't know that I'm ready to say exactly what I want to cut yet, but I think when I was on city council, the same thing. There is a never-ending list of great things that the government can do with other people's money. And so at some point, you have to say, man, that's a great thing. I'm not saying you're wasting. I'm not saying it's fraud. I'm just saying that's not the proper role of government, or we just can't afford it. I've got a list of home improvement projects I really need at my house. But if they're not funded, then I have to put them off.
And beyond the big ticket items, though, if once you are able to get in the system and start filing bills,
yeah,
if you had your way and they said, Brent, we're going to give you three things that you can, we think will sail through, you just got to file them. What are you pushing for this time in these next 2 years?
I think that the big issues for me, and I mean, we may have talked about this last time, but abortion, People think that we've ended abortion in Texas, and we've done well, but frankly, we still have almost as many self-induced abortions now than we did before. It's just instead of happening in a clinic, it's happening at home, which is not as safe. I think we need to end abortion in Texas.
So fully abolish.
What would that mean? Get rid of the morning after pill, Plan B, stuff like that.
Yes, it in Texas? But really, it means that abortion is murder. That's my belief, both as a Christian and as a biology teacher. When that life is conceived in the image of God, it is its own person. We recognize that in Texas law. If you kill or murder a pregnant woman, that's a double murder. Yeah. But if you just kill the baby, it is if you're a doctor, but it's not if you're the mom or if you're the dad. I mean, there's just a and so we really have created a two-class system where we say if you want the baby, then it's murder, but if you don't want the baby, then it's not.
So what more would you legislate then?
Huh?
What more would you legislate?
It's as simple as saying we're going to give equal protection to an unborn child and a not yet born child. We are going to say that if you kill a baby, then we're going to call that murder. There would be punishment for a woman. There's also, the law is not just to punish, it's a tutor. The law teaches us what's right and wrong. And I think for too long we have this is abortion and this is murder. And I believe it's all murder. My family's very involved in caring for pregnant women with unplanned pregnancies. My wife has worked and volunteered at clinics for that. We've been foster parents. We're not just in the fight to stop the murder. We do care about the babies. And so that's a big issue for me. Another issue that's coming to our district that was not even an issue during my campaign is wind farms. Mm-hmm. And I've learned that this is a massive concern across Texas, but wind farms, affect people's cattle and their their land value, their enjoyment of land, and really it's a large government boondoggle that spends a lot more money than energy that it creates.
And do they have wind farms in your district?
Not yet, but they're trying to come in.
So would you be opposed to that and be behind legislation that would prevent it?
I am not against alternative energy sources that make sense. I mean, and I'm not against harnessing the wind and turning it into electricity, or harnessing rivers and turning them into electricity, or the sun and turning it into electricity. That's great. But these projects only survive because there's so much federal taxpayer funding coming in. And if you didn't have that, then it wouldn't be viable
economically. Yeah, those incentives have been a target for a long time.
Absolutely.
For Republicans. Yeah.
And so I have a bill that I'm working on that would say that whatever incentives they get from the feds, we're just going to seize that for the state and create a state tax that offsets it. Hmm. That would really say, okay, if you can stand on your own two feet, then go for it.
How would that go with all these West Texas landowners who have all these acres out there, thousands of acres, and have these things up everywhere because of the incentives? I mean, they're getting this extra paycheck from the feds.
Yeah, but when you say they're getting extra paycheck from the feds, they're getting extra paycheck that comes out of your pocket,
sure,
and my pocket,
yeah,
and everybody who's watching. This is a handout to these West Texas ranch owners.
Who are often Republican, though. They're not Democrats. They're liberals out there who own these ranches.
And God bless them. I mean, that's great. They're utilizing the system as it is in place. And I'm not here to demonize the landowners who use the system for their own benefit. I just want the system to not, the system needs to benefit Texans, not individual people who have the ability to put up a windmill on there.
But what happens? I mean, we've been through these big cold snaps. We're in one now, and you see, even recently, that wind and solar have been sort of propping up the grid on days when we've had a large number of plants that have been offline for one reason or the other. They've been contributing quite a big percentage for parts of the day that are critical. What happens then if we start bringing those wind farms offline?
Yeah, that has happened, and I'm not talking about necessarily taking the wind farms offline that are there. I'm saying in a balanced system, instead of people building wind and solar, which are not as efficient. When you take out subsidies, they're more expensive. They're also not something you can turn on and turn off. You know, a gas plant,
they've got
a diesel
the battery
power
storage
plant,
now.
It can turn out. The battery storage is a whole other issue that is creating, that is concerning people in rural Texas. You know, they moved out into the country, and all of a sudden they have a huge battery facility next to them that the volunteer fire department can't deal with, that shines all these lights, you know, security lights around that messes up their ability to watch the night sky and enjoy their, you know, enjoy their lives. And I'm not saying we have to get rid of all those things. I just think that there are considerations that need to be given that those kinds of projects, historically, electric power plants are in industrial parks in big cities, right. And then you have lines that go out. Well, now we're taking the electric production out into people's pastures, and there needs to be a balance there.
Last question for you. We're going to keep you for 15 minutes, and now we've gone a lot longer than that. But last question is legalizing gambling.
Yes.
Everybody in Dallas-Fort Worth says we're on the edge of this thing because there are new owners of the Dallas Mavs who own casinos in Las Vegas. Lieutenant Governor Patrick told me there just aren't enough votes for this, at least in the Senate. Would you get behind something like this for legalizing gambling, whether it's little bubbles that have been proposed in certain areas of the state or whether it's just blanket?
First of all, I'm a huge Mavericks fan. Love the Mavericks, Luka and Kyrie and everybody. But I'm not for any kind of gambling. In fact, I think gambling is a net economic loss for the state. It preys on really the most vulnerable people. And that doesn't mean there aren't people who can afford it, who enjoy it, and right. do a good job.
Are the votes there for it, though, do you think?
Once again, I haven't whipped it. I don't think so. From what I understand, a lot of the incumbents that lost this last round were pro-gambling, and the challengers coming in are definitely not. So I think the House has lost traction, whatever traction it had towards gambling. I think there's going to be a big push this session. The lottery is up on Sunset, and there's a lot of people saying, hey, the lottery has not delivered what it said that it would.
Why are you dropping the bomb at the end here?
Yeah.
What are you talking about? Yeah. Are we getting rid of the lottery?
You think the lottery is going away?
I don't know.
Is there support to get rid of the lottery?
I would say that there are a lot of people saying, hey, let's take a look at the lottery. Are there the votes there? I don't know. But I think the lottery needs to, there needs to be at least some reform. There will be a push to get rid of it. Probably will survive, but what kind of
reform?
That hasn't been one of my big issues. You can talk to Senator Bob Hall on that one, but I know that there are rules and regulations about how they can sell tickets that they've been.
But do you think it might be cleaned up some?
I think so. I mean, that's what the purpose of the Sunset Commission is to look and say,
at every department,
do we still need this?
Right.
And if we do, then should we change how it is? So that's an appropriate thing for us to do.
Last question from me. You've talked about how you want the culture and you think that the culture will change in the House of Representatives this time around. You know, we hear that from time to time as new sessions start. What's going to change? What do you think is changing?
I think we're going to learn a lot on January 14th when we decide who the speaker is going to be. Is it going to continue this path of a coalition of a small group of Republicans and Democrats that kind of rule with an iron fist over the House? Or is it going to be a reform-minded group of mostly Republicans and some Democrats that are reform-minded that want to kind of level the playing field, decentralize the power of the speaker, and allow for the members to really control the House? And I think that, if you could tell me who was going to win that, I'll tell you what kind of culture we're going to have in the House. But either way, it's going to be a lot of fun, and we're going to do a lot of hard work.
Brent, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Congrats.
Yep.
Okay, y'all, the conversation doesn't stop here. Find us on Twitter and Instagram. We're at Yolitics.
All right, so that was Brent Money, the Republican, one of the Republican freshmen coming in. Of course, we go to both sides of the aisle for this one just to get some really interesting perspectives from people who are coming into this new. And as Brent said, he's going to be sitting up next to the front. He drew, number seven in that lottery. So now we go to the Democrat, Aisha Davis, the representative-elect from District 109. That is just south of downtown Dallas, includes DeSoto, Lancaster. And she's going to be sitting more toward the back. She drew 29 out of 30 in that lottery system. where you get to pick your desk there in the legislature. If you ask me, I think sitting in the back is best.
I like the back too. I prefer the back.
Stay out of the way.
Aisha Davis has been on the program before. You might remember her. She's a former member of the State Board of Education. Mm-hmm. She's replacing Carl Sherman,
yep.
who left the legislature too. So she will be replacing him, representing Cedar Hill, Duncanville, DeSoto. And her main issue, as you can imagine, is going to be education. There's going to be a lot of education coming up this session.
Yeah, here she is.
Click subscribe and get Y'all-itics every week. Y'all-itics, the unofficial political podcast of Texas.
So welcome, thanks for being with us today, and congratulations, Representative-elect Davis. Has that sunk in yet when you hear that?
Oh my gosh, it's been such an exciting journey. I'm just Aisha. So just getting used to this, it's just been amazing. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What are you looking forward to most about this? Because you're leaving the State Board of Education, and this is a whole different ballgame. Yes, there are politics on the SBOE, but the Texas House of Representatives right now is the hotbed.
Well, when I was on the State Board of Education, I got to do some amazing things for public schools, but we had to work within the state law. So if we had stronger state laws for public education, the state board could do even more. So that's why I was so interested in this position once it came available. And it's just been exciting to know all of the things that I can do to work with my colleagues across the House to figure out how we support our public schools.
Well, what are some of those things you want to change then that you saw at the State Board of Education? You said, this law needs to be changed so we can do this, that, or the other. What do you want to do?
We definitely need to figure out how to support the teacher pipeline. We need to make sure
Hire more teachers?
Oh, absolutely. Hire more teachers, prepare more folks to be teachers, make folks excited about the teaching profession. Right now in Texas, we have a lot of folks, there's a hurdle when it comes to certification. Mm-hmm. So figuring out how we can get more folks into those certified programs, those programs for certification, figuring out how we can pay our teachers and keep them in the profession.
Yeah, because we heard a lot about teacher pay raises the last time around, and of course we went into all of these special sessions and it never happened, even with that record surplus.
Right, and even though they didn't get any pay raises, there were still a lot of unfunded mandates that did pass. Mm-hmm. So you had teachers that were doing more work with less pay. And so I definitely want to have some conversations about how we fix that. Mm-hmm.
So the biggest education issue is going to be school vouchers. Are you ready for this fight?
Absolutely.
Are you?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I just definitely want to have conversations about what this could look like in Texas.
Well, what's going to happen, do you think? Because Republicans say they think they're really close to having the votes finally. They've been talking about this for 2 decades, as you know. But they say they're finally close to actually having the votes. Is it going to happen?
I think the more we talk about the potential consequences of what vouchers could do here in Texas, we need to focus more on funding our public schools than we do sending money anywhere else. If there's going to be a true choice, we got to have strong public schools as a choice. So that should be the topic that we talk about more than anything else. And the more we talk about that, the more we'll see it's going to take a lot of money to make sure our public schools have what they need to function. That money isn't going to be really available to give to our private schools. So I think by focusing on what our public schools need, both our public ISDs and our public charters, then you'll see we have a lot of choice around Texas and we got to figure out how to fully fund it.
What are your biggest concerns when it comes to this idea of a universal voucher program? Because, you know, as Jason was saying, this has been gaining momentum among Republicans. They've gotten some of their members out who went against this the last time. They've gotten some more friendly potential votes in there this time. It looks like it, you know, could happen. What specifically would you tell someone who is thinking school choice sounds good? What would you tell them is your concern about vouchers?
I'm looking at what's happening in other states that have passed universal voucher bills into law, Arizona, our neighbors, Oklahoma. And I'm seeing that there hasn't really been a true choice where you see students who are leaving public schools and going to private. They're still not able to afford it. It's a lot more involved. We're talking lunches, we're talking uniforms, we're talking resources. So when we think about, you know, okay, I get this little chunk of money and now I can go anywhere I want, that's not the reality of what a voucher would be. And then we see these budgets in these states and how they started off with a couple of million, you know, thinking it would cost that much, and now they're hundreds of millions, you know, in debt with their voucher systems. We simply can't have that here in Texas.
How do you get that across then if you're, you know, dealing with, you know, you'll be in the minority as a Democrat there in the House? How do you get that point across to the majority?
having those crucial conversations, not just me, but all of the entities that are involved in this discussion, especially those community members that rely on the public schools. So I think all of us coming together to have those crucial conversations, that's the way we start to look at the reality of what vouchers will be here in Texas.
You know, some Republican leaders, though, say we want to fully fund public schools and set aside money for vouchers. If schools were fully funded, public schools fully funded, would you support vouchers?
Well, we got to talk about what fully funding all of our public schools in Texas would look like. And if there's a budget to fully fund public schools where teachers are paid adequately and they have a system of raises that aren't dependent on star scores, and we have teachers that are able to get all of these resources for all these different courses that they're teaching, and we have schools that are able to really invest in their infrastructure and all the new resources and buildings, if we talk about how much that would really cost for the over 1,200 ISDs and the charter schools that we adopt and approve and expand every single year, that's a lot of money. So until we realistically talk about what a fully funded public school is, then we're gonna see those numbers are a lot more than what I think the idea is to be able to have both a system of fully funded schools and a voucher system.
And do you have any arguments about still tying things to star scores when, if you did have a voucher program, kids who are going to those voucher schools wouldn't be expected to take a star test or have any kind of measure?
Absolutely, and even deeper than that, what you'll see, what we've seen, is you'll have students, they're not gonna accept students that have exceptional needs if they don't have the staff that's there to be able to serve those students. So you'll have the ISDs who are educating an array of students with a bunch of different needs. And you'll have the private schools that'll have the students who are top tier, who don't really have as many special needs as some of those other students that aren't being accepted.
And they'd be able to select basically who
absolutely
comes to their school.
Absolutely, the choice isn't necessarily with the families, it's still with the school. Mm. You don't get to say, oh, I have a voucher, so I'm automatically accepted. So it's not truly a parental choice.
Mm. What if there are schools, private schools that don't take vouchers? Because they don't have to, you know, take that money and be in the program.
Right, and they don't. They can continue to function as they have, not accept those. But I believe schools that do accept the voucher, there has to be some accountability for them. They have to be able to say, okay, well, we're going to accept students, you know, regardless of your needs. We're going to accept students regardless of your background or your zip code. So until we really start to talk about how it's going to be a true parental choice, then it's a lot that's deep into the voucher.
You're ready for
discussion.
This. I can tell you're ready for this.
Yes.
One. You're fired up.
Well, you've been on the
she
state.
Said, bring it to us,
yes.
Huh?
Well, of course, you served two terms on the State Board of Education.
Yes.
You've been a teacher for
yes.
many years. You've also gotten a master's in education. You're pursuing a PhD in education.
Yes.
So this is obviously your passion,
yes.
and so you bring that knowledge to this. You know, someone would say that you're a specialist in this. How much is that going to help you to be able to make those arguments once you get into the legislature?
You know, it's been quite a few folks on both sides of the aisle that appreciate that background in education, you know, being a teacher and being on the State Board of Ed, and they're curious to know how things function over there. Mm. So being able to bring that perspective will help. I'm gonna focus more on issues rather than politics.
Mm.
And so when we take that out and just talk about the things that are going on in the reality of our public schools, then we can really start to think about ways to improve things for them.
Is it possible to take politics out of it?
I was about to ask that question, yeah. Come on. You and I have known each other for a while.
We were able to do some amazing things at the State Board of Ed. It was 15 of us. It was 6-9 when I first was elected, 10-5 when I left.
You mean 10 Republicans, 5 Democrats?
Yes.
Yeah.
And we were still able to fight for strong public schools, for teachers to have fair opportunities to be able to move around if they needed to. So it was some really hard things that we had to come together on. And I didn't win every fight, but together we were able to do some amazing things.
Didn't you get the African American Studies program through in a unanimous vote, though?
Absolutely, absolutely. Not only
that's
was
surprising
it
in this climate right now. I mean, we hear so much about, you know, especially, you know, if you look at Florida and anti-woke and that sort of
killing
thing.
Killing DEI. Yeah, absolutely.
That's kind of surprising.
Well, it was two things. One, all of my colleagues contributed to that course. They were all suggesting different things. My colleague Pat Hardy in Fort Worth is the one who told us about convict leasing. Hmm. None of us had ever even heard of it until she said it. And then the bodies in Sugar Land were discovered probably months after that discussion.
Hmm.
So all of them were just, you know, so helpful in creating the course. Now, that was in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
It was before the anti-CRT bills passed into law.
Mm-hmm. Critical race theory.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so now there's a different perspective of some of the information in our ethnic studies courses. We have our Native American studies course has been held up because there's some concern with critical race theory in it. So it was a different time when we adopted that course than it is now, but I'm glad we were able to do it.
So the other big news in the House is going to be the speaker's race. It's going to be a Republican who gets it, but what's remarkable to me is that Republicans, since they're not unified, they have to go begging and pleading to Democrats for votes. Do you ever think you'd be in this position?
Well, I have not signed on to anyone yet.
You haven't?
No. I wanted to make sure that I knew enough to make the right decision.
So what else do you need to know about these two? Are you going to wait until day of, on the first day of the legislature?
I likely will, because it's, you know, a couple of days. Still learning more and more about each of them and some of their priorities and some of the folks they surround themselves with and some of their goals for the session. So just taking time to really think about it, talk to constituents, talk to other leaders around Dallas County and other leaders in the House. It's been a journey figuring it all out.
Has your phone been ringing, though?
Have they reached out to you?
Have the main players reached out?
A lot of folks have been reaching out on both sides, on both sides of the aisle. And it's been nice getting to know a lot of folks that I never thought I would be talking to because of this, but it's a little two dozen or so of us that have not made a decision. How we decide will pretty much decide who the speaker will be.
Now, how do you know it's two dozen who haven't made a decision yet? Is there like a group text, or how does that work? How do you keep up with this?
Yeah, just looking at the numbers of Democrats that have signed with Burroughs already, and the number of Democrats who haven't signed at all. So just thinking of those numbers, the folks who haven't really been, talking to one side more than the other, we really could make a difference on who the speaker actually ends up being.
It's a lot of power as an incoming freshman.
And I want to do the right things with it.
So what would someone have to say to get your vote to be speaker? What would Burroughs or Cook have to tell you or offer you?
I definitely would like a speaker who cares about the fidelity of the process of lawmaking in the House. So someone who wants to make sure we have strong rules where someone could, bring points of order, where someone could introduce bills, where there's a fair opportunity for folks to serve on committees and lead committees. So someone who's really interested in making sure good laws pass through, bills pass through there, more than anything else.
There's a chance that even after this speaker fight is settled, that there are going to be disgruntled Republicans on one side of this or the other, because again, this is Republican versus Republican going for this, and these are two pretty defined factions of that party. If one side is disgruntled after this is all said and done, does that open opportunities for the Democratic Party? Because, for decades now, Democrats have not held power in the House. Does it open up an opportunity if there is a division within the party?
There is a clear division. I believe when it's time to make policy, they'll come together a little bit more, because even though they're divided on this, they still have a lot of common ideas when it comes to policy. So I do believe there is an opportunity for Democrats to be a little more influential this session than before. From my understanding, it's never been a speaker's race. It's just been undecided this close to opening day. So that in itself says, okay, well, this is a different type of session that's going to happen. And what do we do to make sure that the voice of Texans is heard? Democrats have historically fought for those who have been marginalized and whose voice really isn't at the table enough in Austin. So how do we use that division that's going on to make sure that that voice is at the table and that all Texans get a fair chance?
I asked you about your lapel pin when you walked in. It's a nice lapel pin. And you said it's from Sinfronia Thompson, veteran lawmaker from Houston. She is highly respected by both sides of the aisle. What kind of advice did she give you?
Listen.
Oh, I thought you were telling Jason to listen. He needs that advice as well.
Either way, I'm listening. So,
told you to listen.
To listen.
Really?
It's a different ball game at the House. And just because I've served before, it's not like this. And I'm so glad for that advice, because I was able to sit back and listen what's going on with the House Democratic Caucus, listen what's going on during freshman orientation, when it was folks coming bringing all kinds of information, you know, throughout the week. And I've been able to learn so much in these last couple of weeks. Yeah. Hmm.
Has it been overwhelming? I mean, when you go to this week-long orientation, you're trying to, you know, get up to speed, yeah. especially as a freshman. You're trying to get up to speed and figure out how this all works.
Yeah. I was able to do a lot of homework beforehand, so I had some expectations on some things, and I've built some relationships at the Capitol from, you know, previously being on the state board. So I was coming in kind of with an idea, and so, you know, leaning on my family, leaning on my fiance, they've been just so supportive in making sure that I'm able to just really focus on this and figure it out so I can be effective in the next session.
You said do homework. What did you do? Did you call people? Did you look at news articles? How do you prepare for this as a newly elected state representative?
All of that, but one of the main things I did for homework came at the suggestion of Representative John Bryant.
He's a Democrat in Houston, yeah.
No, he's here in Dallas.
Oh, I'm sorry, in Dallas, yeah.
Yes. Read the rules book. So been learning about rules and how the rules function at the House. I just got good with Robert's rules, because that's what we use at the state board, so I'm coming over like, I got it. I'm like, no, rules at the House are totally different. So understanding how the rules works, that's going to make all the difference in being involved.
It's all about processes.
Oh, absolutely.
Do you spend time to, like, especially when you're there for orientation, and this is a big class of freshmen coming in. There's been a lot of turnover there in the House. Do you spend any time trying to buddy up, get to know a few Republicans? Because you've talked a lot about working across the aisle at the State Board of Education and trying to foster that to get your initiatives pushed through. Are you sort of scoping out, like, who do I think I can work with here and develop a relationship with right away?
Yeah, no, you know, I actually had a very pleasant time during freshman orientation getting to know my colleagues from both sides of the aisle. Hmm. So some folks that, you know, were like, oh, you probably won't get to know her, you probably won't get to know him. We've all had a chance to connect on something that we have in common. Hmm. So I had a chance to, you know, sit at tables with different people from all across Texas. I got to know folks from, you know, different ideologies and things, but we all found something in common. So I found way more allies than I ever thought I would in my freshman class.
Were you taking notes?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah.
Wow. So last thing I have for you, too, just curious what your constituents now are telling you they want you to do for your district in Dallas County.
Definitely, well, beyond public education, looking at business ownership, and looking at our hub program, our historically underutilized businesses, to figure out how more small businesses can get resources. That's the heart of Texas economy. So figuring that out, housing, development, how do we make our area just amazing? There's so much potential. We have a lot of rural area, as well as we're right here in Dallas County. Mm-hmm. So how do we maximize that area so that DeSoto, Duncanville, Cedar Hill, Dallas, just the most amazing place in all of Texas?
You have a lot to do.
You know, I was surprised too that, and I had seen this from you, that House District 109, which mm-hmm. you'll be representing, has more union members than any other district in Dallas County. I didn't know that. So that's a big thought and concern for you going in a state that traditionally isn't very union friendly.
Yes, we have a lot of good opportunities for different industries and workforce development in District 109. And we do have a lot of those union members who choose to work there, and it's amazing. They fight hard to make sure that every worker has a fair opportunity. We actually want to expand that and have more opportunities for even more people. So just maximizing the area that we have. Representative Sherman did a fantastic job in making sure the district looked the way it did. So just making sure that we have all the resources to make it as great as we possibly can.
Carl Sherman Sr., of course, who was the longtime rep of District 109.
Yes.
My last thing for you is beyond education. I know that, you know, that is your number one priority. Is there something, have you hashed out a bill on something else, or is there a bill in your head that you really would like to get through that is not education?
You know, I've been having some really good conversations about healthcare and women's reproductive rights. Mm. There have been some women who have died because of the bills that passed into law last session. So figuring out what do we need to do to keep Texas women safe and healthy. I had a great conversation just yesterday with the AFIA Center about black women and maternity mortality. Mm. So figuring that out, where we need to scale back some things from the bill that passed, or maybe add some different language to make sure that women are healthy and able to take care of their babies. That's also a priority of mine.
I'm going to pull a Whiteley here and do one more last question,
because
this is his famous thing. You are fairly comfortable, I would imagine, at the State Board of Education. You were two terms in. This is your passion. What made you, what possessed you to go, you know what, I'm going to run for the Texas House now, knowing that you would be with the party that has been in the minority in the House for decades now, and the House has been steadily moving to the right for the past, you know, however many sessions. What possessed you to think, well, I'm going to go over there, and I think I can make a difference there?
Public education is the foundation of a strong community. You know, the stronger the public education system there, the stronger the economy is going to be. So using that to build laws so you have a strong public education system, a strong healthcare system, housing opportunities, I wanted to be a voice to know how we can all put this together and create a better Texas. So it's not going to be easy. None of this has ever been easy. And I've made a lot of sacrifices knowing that. But I'm very proud to be able to start some of those conversations and add my perspective, add some data to it, so we can really come up with some good things for Texans and for schools. So it was an easy decision when I thought about the potential of being able to, you know, have more resources for those Texans that really need it.
Hmm. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, congrats.
Thank you.
Hey, y'all. Want to see the Jasons Talk Politics? Download the WFAA Plus streaming app for your smart TV and watch the latest episode of Y'allitics,